After the Morphine left Lebanon, its first step was the bays and inlets of Sicily's western coast. There, Palermo's fishing trawlers would meet ocean-going freighters from the Middle East and international waters, pick up the drug cargo, and then smuggle it into fishing villages scattered along the rugged coastline. Once the morphine base was safely ashore, it was transformed into heroin into one of Luciano's clandestine laboratories. Typical of these was the candy factory opened in Palermo in 1949. It was leased to one of Luciano's cousins and managed by Don Calogero himself. The laboratory operated without incident until April 11, 1954, when the Roman daily Avanti published a photograph of the factory under the headline, "Textiles and Sweets on the Drug Route," unquote. That evening, the factory was closed and the laboratory's chemists were reportedly smuggled out of the country. Once heroin had been manufactured and packaged for export, Luciano used his mafia connections to send it through a maze of international routes to the United States. Not all of the mafiosi deported from the United States stayed in Sicily. To reduce the chance of seizure, Luciano had placed many of them in such European cities as Milan, Hamburg, Paris, and Marseille, so they could forward the heroin to the United States after it arrived from Sicily concealed in fruits, vegetables, or candy. From Europe, heroin was shipped directly to New York or smuggled through Canada and Cuba. While Luciano's prestige and organizational genius were an invaluable asset, and a large part of his success was due to his ability to... While Luciano's prestige and organizational genius were an invaluable asset, a large part of his success was due to his ability to pick reliable subordinates. After he was deported from the United States in 1946, he charged his longtime associate, Meyer Lansky, with the responsibility for managing his financial empire. Lansky also played a key role in organizing Luciano's heroin syndicate. He supervised smuggling operations, negotiated with Corsican heroin manufacturers, and managed the collection and concealment of the enormous profits. Lansky's control over the Caribbean and his relationship with the Florida-based Trafficante family were of particular importance, since many of the heroin shipments passed through Cuba or Florida on their way to America's urban markets. For almost 20 years, the Luciano-Lansky-Trafficante troika remained a major feature of the international heroin traffic.
Continuing. Organized crime was welcome in pre-revolutionary Cuba, and Havana was probably the most important transit point for Luciano's European heroin shipments. The leaders of Luciano's heroin syndicate were at home in the Cuban capital and regarded it as a safe city. Lansky owned most of the city's casinos, and the Trafficante family served as Lansky's resident managers in Havana. Luciano's 1947 visit to Cuba laid the groundwork for Havana's subsequent role in international narcotics smuggling traffic. Arriving in January, Luciano summoned the leaders of American organized crime, including Meyer Lansky, to Havana for a meeting, and began paying extravagant bribes to prominent Cuban officials as well. The director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics at the time felt that Luciano's presence in Cuba was an ominous sign. Quote, "I had received a preliminary report through a Spanish-speaking agent I had sent to Havana, and I read this to the Cuban ambassador. The report stated that Luciano had already become friendly with a number of high Cuban officials through the lavish use of expensive gifts. Luciano had developed a full-fledged plan which envisioned the Caribbean as his center of operations. Cuba was to be made the center of all international narcotic operations," unquote. Pressure from the United States finally resulted in the revocation of Luciano's residence visa and his return to Italy, but not before he had received commitments from organized crime leaders in the United States to distribute the regular heroin shipments he promised them from Europe. The Caribbean, on the whole, was a happy place for American racketeers. Most governments were friendly and did not interfere with the business ventures that brought some badly needed capital into their generally poorer countries. Organized crime had been well established in Havana long before Luciano's landmark voyage. During the 1930s, Meyer Lansky, quote, "discovered the Caribbean for northeastern syndicate bosses and invested their illegal profits in an assortment of lucrative gambling ventures." In 1933, Lansky moved into the Miami Beach area and took over most of the illegal off-track betting and a variety of hotels and casinos. He was also reportedly responsible for organized crime's decision to declare Miami a, quote, "free city," in other words, not subject to the usual rules of territorial monopoly. Following his success in Miami, Lansky moved to Havana for 3 years, and by the beginning of World War II, he owned the Hotel Nacional's casino and was leasing the municipal racetrack from a reputable New York bank. Burdened by the enormous scope and diversity of his holdings, Lansky had to delegate much of the responsibility for daily management to local gangsters. One of the Lansky's earliest associates in Florida was Santo Traficante Sr., a Sicilian-born Tampa gangster. Traficante had earned his reputation as an effective organizer in the Tampa gambling rackets, and was already a figure of some stature when Lansky first arrived in Florida. By the time Lansky returned to New York in 1940, Traficante had assumed responsibility for Lansky's interests in Havana and Miami. By the early 1950s, Traficante had himself become such an important figure that he in turn delegated his Havana concessions to Santo Traficante Jr., the most talented of his six sons. Santo Jr.'s official position in Havana was that of manager of the Sans Souci Casino, but he was far more important than his title indicates. As his father's financial representative and ultimately Meyer Lansky's, Santo Jr. controlled much of Havana's tourist industry and became quite close to the pre-Castro dictator Fulgencio Batista. Moreover, it was reportedly his responsibility to receive the bulk shipments of heroin from Europe and forward them through Florida to New York and other major urban centers, where their distribution was assisted by local mafia bosses. Just to mention, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. So now we see another major change in the drug traffic, and as Lucky Luciano begins to develop his stranglehold on the heroin traffic and puts his assistant, Meyer Lansky, more and more in charge of American operations, Meyer Lansky discovers the benefits of the Caribbean and of Miami. And, of course, to this very day, Miami is probably the U.S. center for illegal drug traffic. However, one of the main things that's changed is that Cuba is no longer the main stopping point in the Western Hemisphere for the illegal drugs coming in. And, of course, the reason for this was the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power and drove Fulgencio Batista and his cronies out. And because along with Batista and his cronies went the mafia, and especially Meyer Lansky and the Traficantes, and also their grip on the drug traffic and the gambling and all those things that had made Cuba such a paradise for the mafia.
Again, the Traficante-Meyer Lansky axis is something that's going to come back with a vengeance later on in this series that we're doing. We'll be looking at the Traficante group in particular much later in the program. Yeah, I think this would be a good time to do it.
All right, we'll do that then. We're going to take a break for a few minutes and give you all a chance to get up and turn around, because right now we're going to be going on after this and beginning to talk about some very interesting things having to do with France, the Marseille connection, the Corsican Mafia, otherwise known as the Union Corse, and a variety of other fascinating topics that some of you may not know about, and if so, you owe it to yourself to stick with us. We'll be back in just a few moments, Dave and myself, and we will have more of Radio Free America for you right here on KFJC. Although, as mentioned at the top of the broadcast, this is going to be a three and possibly a four-part series. And don't worry, folks, if you have a favorite drug you want to know about, we'll be getting to them. Give us time. But tonight we're talking about drugs, and we're quoting extensively from an unfortunately not very well-known book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy, as well as a few other works. But this is an excellent book, very hard to get a hold of, but it is, as I said earlier in the broadcast, perhaps the seminal work in the field. It certainly got a lot of other people started on this stuff, and it's a book that you deserve for yourself if you bump into it to pick up a copy of it somewhere. It's well worth your time and trouble to have, and it's very hard to find. We've been talking so far about the initial connections between originally the Office of Naval Intelligence and then the OSS and the American military with the Sicilian Mafia, the fact that the Sicilian Mafia, which was almost wiped out by Mussolini, was brought back into a position of power first by cooperating with the American military occupation of Sicily, and then later on because the American intelligence and military people found them to be, as they saw it, a wholesome alternative to the indigenous communist and leftist freedom fighters who actually had been the resistance during the war. But the American military did not find that to be a healthy thought, that these people would be in power after the war. So instead, wherever they went, they put back in either the original fascist functionaries or the mafia. Then we talked about how after the war, how Lucky Luciano set his heroin network in motion, that was for a span of some 10 years, not only the by far the world's leading heroin network, but it also never suffered suffered a major arrest or a seizure, and how the heroin-using populace in the United States jumped dramatically after World War II, to a large extent because of the American military and intelligence establishment's cooperation with Luciano and the Sicilian Mafia.
We got some problems here. That's our problem. We also took a look at the eventual establishment of Cuba as a major transshipment point for the. For the drugs from. We looked at the installation of Cuba as a major transshipment point of the Luciano drug network. Okay, the drugs were first left the Middle East. They were grown in Turkey. They departed from Lebanon, went to the western coast of Sicily, and eventually, as we're going to see, Marseille became the major refining point. We're going to get into that in just a minute. From there, they went to Cuba, and from Cuba, of course, to the United States. We're going to come back to Cuba, the Lansky-Trafficante axis, in just a little bit. Well, actually, probably in a couple of programs, but Cuba and the Trafficante group are going to come in later on, come to figure in this scenario in a big, big way. The point here being that it was U.S. Naval Intelligence and the Military Intelligence Alliance with the Mafia, first of all, in Operation Underworld to secure American docks from sabotage, and then by installing the Sicilian Mafia in power in Sicily after the American invasion there. This was the factor which created the resurgence of the Mafia in that part of the country, so in that part of the world. So this basically is what we're looking at here. The U.S. military intelligence reinstalls the Mafia in Sicily. The Mafia with Luciano then is a dominant factor in restoring the drug traffic. Why don't you just leave the tape alone over there, Nib. We're recording on this one right here because
it's rewound.
Can't think and monitor the tape at the same time. It's just my brain ain't big enough. So once again, recapping here because you have to forgive us, folks, but we have to maintain our engineering duties here while we're being scholars, and sometimes that's not easy to do. If you hear occasional bump in the text here, it's probably just because we're maintaining our equipment and monitoring tapes and so forth. Anyway, again, the Mafia restored in Sicily by the U.S. military. That restoration of the Mafia through Operation Underworld and their use as anti-communist cadres is an instrumental factor in restoring the, at that point, almost moribund world heroin trade. At this point now, U.S. intelligence is not directly involved with the trafficking of narcotics, but via their machinations in the world and via through a sort of a quid pro quo, whereby in exchange for their anti-communist expertise, the Mafia was more or less left alone. We see the U.S. intelligence essentially creating the world conditions for a resurgence in the world heroin trade. We're going to take a look at at further efforts in that regard right now. And in addition to restoring the Sicilian Mafia, the CIA was immediately after World War II responsible for placing the Union Corps, the Corsican organized crime syndicate, into a similar situation with regard to the docks in Marseille. We're going to take a look at Marseille's development as a major heroin shipment, as a major heroin refining center, and its work in turn with the Luciano Lansky mob here in just a minute. Returning again to the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy. Now, McCoy here is going to comment briefly on a situation which we touched on earlier, namely the fact that it was the spirited resistance given by the various communist groups in Europe to the fascists which won them much of the popularity which they retain to a certain extent even to this day, in particular Italy and France. In France, as McCoy points out here, the Communist Party represented for all intents and purposes the only effective resistance against the Nazis. McCoy comments on that in the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. The resistance in France itself was hopelessly divided between the communists and non-communists. Although wartime American propaganda films and post-war French cinema have projected an image of France as a nation in chains, with every other citizen a nighttime warrior, most Frenchmen collaborated with the Germans willingly enough and were indifferent, if not outright hostile, toward the resistance. In contrast, the Communist Party, with its strong anti-fascist ideology and disciplined cell structure, began resistance activities almost immediately and remained the only effective armed organization in France until the 1944 Allied landings in Normandy. Now, that's an important factor to keep in mind here, that it was the Communist resistance which won them their popularity. Now, after after VE Day, basically, and after the surrender of Nazi Germany, the following situation was in effect in France. France was extremely poor. It was had suffered a great deal of damage during the war, and extreme austerity measures were in effect throughout the country. Marseille had a very large communist element in its working class that were very well organized, and they had been very active in the resistance in response to a number of different things, notably the raising of the tram fares, which made getting to work extremely difficult for a lot of the workers. There was a strike in Marseille. Now, eventually, the response to the strike was in response to the strike, the socialist government of Marseille hired a number of different gangsters from the Union Corse. That is an organized crime syndicate run from the island of Corsica, very similar to the Sicilian mafia in function, although it's organized very differently. The Corsican syndicate, the Union Corse, was instrumental in beating up a number of different communists in the city of Marseille, including several several members of the city council who belonged to the Communist Party. In response to the Union Corse's or the Corsican syndicate's beating of the city council members who were communists, the communists organized a huge general strike in Marseille, which quickly spread to the rest of France. So the strike that you're going to hear Nip referring to here was a huge general strike in effect in France. It began in Marseille and spread to the rest of the country. And bear in mind that this was spurred by very, very difficult conditions. The conditions for workers in France at this time were extremely poor, and the incident in Marseille, which was one of the best organized cities from the communist standpoint, was more or less the match to the tinderbox of France at the time.
You're also going to hear the name the Guérinis mentioned, G-U-E-R-I-N-I, the Guérinis. In this case, Antoine and Barthélemy Guérini were two Corsican brothers who ran one of the Union Corse gangs, and they had fired on some strikers. And in fact, one of the demonstrators was killed because of this action. This led to an increase of tension.
Good point. It was the Guérinis, too, who beat up the communist city council members, too, and that was another of the major elements leading to the demonstrations, which were fired on. So the Guérini brothers are front and center here, and they will be instrumental in the scenario which follows.
Now, this particular strike, as a matter of fact, that we're going to be reading about right now, was called when the Guérinis were arrested for the shooting, and then 4 days after they were arrested, the police mysteriously dropped all the charges, and they were allowed to go free. And the local labor confederation decided that this was too much and called a general strike. Again, reading from Politics of Heroin. The strike was universal throughout France. Marseille workers had reached the breaking point at about the same time as their comrades in the rest of France. Spontaneous wildcat strikes erupted in factories, mines, and railway yards throughout the country. As militant workers took to the streets, demonstrating for fair wages and lower prices, the Communist Party leadership was reluctantly forced to take action. By the way, for those of you not familiar, a wildcat strike is a strike that has not been organized from the top down. It's a strike that occurs at a local level or at a site or at a plant. So what they're saying here is that the Communist Party leadership actually followed the strike rather than leading the strike. The Communist Party leadership was reluctantly forced to take action. On November 14th, the day after Marseille's unions went on strike, the leftist labor confederation, CGT, called for a nationwide general strike. Contrary to what one might expect, French communist leaders of this era were hardly wild-eyed revolutionaries. For the most part, they were conservative, middle-aged men who had served their nation well during the wartime resistance and now wanted, above all else, to take part in the governance of their country. Their skillful leadership of the wartime resistance had earned them the respect of the working class, and thanks to their efforts, French unionists had accepted low post-war wages and abstained from strikes in 1945 and 1946. However, their repeated support for draconian government austerity measures began to cost them votes in union elections, and in mid-1946, one U.S. State Department analyst reported that communist leaders, quote, could no longer hold back the discontent of the rank and file, unquote. When wildcat strikes and demonstrations erupted in mid-November 1947, the Communist Party was forced to support them or forfeit its leadership of the working class. At best, its support was half-hearted. But by late November, 3 million workers were out on strike, and the French economy was almost paralyzed. Ignoring their own analysts, U.S. foreign policy planners interpreted the 1947 strike as a political ploy on the part of the Communist Party and feared that it was a prelude to a, quote, takeover of the government. The reason for this blindness was simple. By mid-1947, the Cold War had frozen over, and all political events were seen in terms of the, quote, worldwide ideological clash between Eastern communism and Western democracy, unquote. Apprehensive over Soviet gains in the Eastern Mediterranean and the growth of communist parties in Western Europe, the Truman administration drew up the multi-billion dollar European Recovery Plan in May, known popularly as the Marshall Plan, and established the CIA in September. Determined to save France from an imminent communist coup, the CIA moved in to help break up the strike, choosing the Socialist Party as its nightstick. On the surface, it may have seemed a bit out of character for the CIA to be backing anything so far left as a socialist party. However, there were only three major political parties in France: socialist, communist, and Gaullist. And by a simple process of elimination, the CIA wound up bedding down with the socialists. While General de Gaulle was far too independent for American tastes, socialist leaders were rapidly losing political ground to the communists and were only too willing to collaborate with the CIA. Writing in the Saturday Evening Post in 1967, the former director of the CIA's International Organizations Division, Thomas W. Braden, explained the agency's strategy of using leftists to fight leftists. "It was personified by J. Lovestone," he writes, "assistant to David Dubinsky in the International Ladies' Garment Workers' Union. Once chief of the Communist Party in the United States, Lovestone had enormous grasp of foreign intelligence operations. In 1947, the Communist Confédération Générale du Travail led a strike in Paris, which came very close to paralyzing the French economy. A takeover of the government was feared. Into this crisis stepped Lovestone and his assistant Irving Brown. With funds from Dubinsky's union, they organized Force Ouvrière, a non-communist union. When they ran out of money, they appealed to the CIA. Thus began the secret subsidy of free trade unions, which soon spread to Italy. Without that subsidy, post-war history might have gone very differently." Shortly after the general strike began, the socialist faction split off from the CGT, the Confédération Générale du Travail, and formed a separate union, Force Ouvrière, with CIA funds. CIA payments on the order of $1 million a year guaranteed the Socialist Party a strong electoral base in the labor movement and gave its leaders the political strength to lead the attack on striking workers. While Marseille socialist leader Gaston Defferre called for an anti-communist crusade from the floor of the National Assembly, and in the columns of Le Provençal, Socialist Minister of the Interior Jules Moch directed brutal police actions against striking workers. With the advice and cooperation of the U.S. military attaché in Paris, Moch requested the call-up of 80,000 reservists and mobilized 200,000 troops to battle the strikers. Faced with this overwhelming force, the CGT called off the strike on December 9th, after less than a month on the picket lines.
Continuing. The bloodiest battleground of the general strike had not been in Paris, as Braden indicates, but in Marseille. Victory in Marseille was essential for U.S. foreign policy for a number of reasons. As one of the most important international ports in France, Marseille was a vital beachhead for Marshall Plan exports to Europe. Continued communist control of its docks would threaten the efficiency of the Marshall Plan and any future aid programs. As the second largest city in France, continued communist domination of the Marseille electorate would increase the chance that the Communist Party might win enough votes to form a national government. The Communist Party already controlled 28% of the vote and was the largest party in France. The growing split between Marseille's communist and socialist parties and Defferre's willingness to serve American interests had already been revealed in National Assembly debates over the bloody incidents on November 12th in Marseille. Instead of criticizing the Guarinis for beating the municipal councillors and murdering the sheet metal worker, socialist leader Gaston Defferre chose to attack the communists. Quote, "The American and English flags which were hanging from the city hall were slashed by communist hordes. We have proof of what the communists are capable. I trust that the government will take note of the consequences. The Socialist Party deplores these incidents, but it will not tolerate that those who try to pass here as representatives will be able to defy the law," unquote. Several days later, communist deputy Jean Christoffel, C-R-I-S-T-O-F-O-L, rebutted Defferre's accusations, charging that the Guarini's gangsters were in the employ of both Gaullist and Socialist parties in Marseille. When Defferre rose to deny even knowing Monsieur Guarini, another communist deputy reminded him that a Guarini cousin was the editor of Defferre's newspaper, Le Provençal. Then, Christoffel took over to reveal some disturbing indications pointing to the Marseille milieu's revival. Underworld collaborators were being paroled from prison, and government officials were allowing milieu nightclubs to open, among them the Guarini's Parakeet Club. The club had been closed in June of 1947 by order of Cristofol himself, then town mayor. By the way, interrupting here, milieu here is a slang term for the Marseille underworld. It's kind of like the mob in American parlance, but milieu is a French slang term for the Corsican syndicate in Marseille. The socialists, continuing now with politics of heroin in Southeast Asia, the socialists' first step in breaking Marseille's strike was purging suspected communist supporters from the CRS police units. Interrupting again, the CRS police units were an ad hoc constabulary put together in Marseille, largely involving elements of the Marseille Communist Party, and it's worth noting that the CRS units had been very instrumental in cracking down, on the milieu, on the Corsican syndicate in Marseille. Resuming. The socialists' first step in breaking Marseille's strike was purging suspected communist supporters from the CRS police units. Once this was accomplished, these units could easily be ordered to use violent tactics against the striking workers. Thus, although official reports had nothing but praise for the cool professionalism of these officers, socialist mayor Gaston Defferre unjustly accused them of having sided with the demonstrators during the rioting of November 12th. After socialist cadres drew up a list of suspected CRS communists, Mayor Defferre passed it along to Socialist Minister Jules Moch, M-O-C-H, who ordered the blacklisted officers fired. This action by the socialists was certainly appreciated by the hard-pressed Corsican syndicates as well. In sharp contrast to the regular police, CRS units had been cracking down on the milieu's smuggling and black market activities. Once these communist officers had been purged, CRS units started attacking picket lines with unrestrained violence. But it would take more than ordinary police repression to break the determination of Marseille's 80,000 striking workers. If the U.S. was to have its victory in Marseille, it would have to fight for it. And the CIA proceeded to do just that. Through their contacts with the Socialist Party, the CIA had sent agents and a psychological warfare team to Marseille, where they dealt directly with Corsican syndicate leaders through the Guarini brothers. The CIA's operatives supplied arms and money to Corsican gangs for assaults on communist picket lines and harassment of the important union officials. During the month-long strike, the CIA's gangsters and the purged CRS police units murdered a number of striking workers and mauled the picket lines. Finally, the CIA psychological warfare team prepared pamphlets, radio broadcasts, and posters aimed at discouraging workers from continuing the strike. Some of the Psy War team's maneuvers were inspired. At one point, the American government threatened to ship 65,000 sacks of flour meant for the hungry city back to the United States unless the dockers unloaded them immediately. The pressure of violence and hunger was too great, and on December 9th, Marseille's workers abandoned the strike, along with their fellow workers in the rest of France. There were some ironic finishing touches. On Christmas Eve of 1947, 87 boxcars arrived at the Marseille train station carrying flour, milk, sugar, and fruit as gifts from the American people, unquote, amidst the cheers of hundreds of school children waving tiny American flags. The Guarinis gained enough power and status from their role in smashing the 1947 strike to emerge as the new leaders of the Corsican underworld. But while the CIA was instrumental in restoring the Corsican underworld's political power, it was not until the 1950 dock strike that the Guarinis gained enough power to take control of the Marseille waterfront. This combination of political influence and control of the docks created the perfect environmental conditions for the growth of Marseille's heroin laboratories, fortuitously at exactly the same time that Mafia boss Lucky Luciano was seeking an alternate source of heroin supply.
So again, we see where the growth of the heroin trade is inextricably linked with the use by intelligence, specifically the CIA, which has just been created, the use of intelligence's use of underworld gangs, the very people who deal in heroin, as political hitmen to prevent the rise of any sort of alternative or leftist governments in Europe immediately post-World War II.
Of course, this was exactly the role that we saw the Sicilian Mafia installed in by the OSS and AMGOT in Italy and in Sicily.
Continuing now. The same austere economic conditions that had sparked the 1947 strike also produced the 1950 shutdown. Conditions for the workers had not improved in the intervening 3 years, and if anything, had grown worse. Marseille, with its tradition of working-class militancy, had even more reason for striking. Marseille was France's gateway to the Orient, through which material, particularly American munitions and supplies, was transported to the French Expeditionary Corps fighting in Indochina. The Indochina was about as unpopular with the French people then as the Vietnam War is with so many of the American people today. By the way, for those of you who are younger listeners or are not real familiar with history, the Indochina War was France being thrown out of Vietnam. It is the Vietnamese War. It's just the first part of the Vietnamese War. Vietnam was called Indochina in those days. The Indochina War was about as unpopular with the French people as the Vietnam War is with so many American people today. This was written in 1972. And Ho Chi Minh had helped to found the French Communist Party and was a popular hero in France among the leftist working class members, especially in Marseille with its many resident Indochinese. In January, Marseille dock workers began a selective boycott of those freighters carrying supplies to the war zone. And on February 3rd, the CGT convened a meeting of Marseille dock workers at which a declaration was issued demanding, quote, the return of the Expeditionary Corps from Indochina to put an end to the war in Vietnam, and urging, quote, all unions to launch the most effective actions possible against the war in Vietnam, unquote. The movement of arms shipments to Indochina was paralyzed. Although the Atlantic ports joined in the embargo in early February, they were not as effective or as important as the Marseille strike. By mid-February, the shutdown had spread to the metal industries, the mines, and the railways. But most of the strikes were half-hearted. On February 18th, the Paris newspaper Combat reported that Marseille was once again the hard core. 70% of Marseille's workers supported the strike, compared to only 2% in Bordeaux, 20% in Toulouse, and 20% in Nice. Once more, Marseille's working-class militancy called for special methods, and the CIA's Thomas Braden later recalled how he dealt with the problem. Quote, on the desk in front of me as I write these lines is a creased and faded yellow paper. It bears the following inscription in pencil. Quote, received from Warren G. Haskins, $15,000, signed Norris A. Grambo, unquote. I went in search of this paper on the day the newspapers disclosed the, quote, scandal of the Central Intelligence Agency's connections with American students and labor leaders. It was a wistful search, and when it ended, I found myself feeling sad. For I was Warren G. Haskins. Norris A. Grambo was Irving Brown of the American Federation of Labor. The $15,000 was from the vaults of the CIA, and the yellow paper is the last memento I possess of a vast and secret operation. It was my idea to give $15,000 to Irving Brown. He needed it to pay off his strong-arm squads in the Mediterranean ports, so that American supplies could be unloaded against the opposition of communist dock workers. Unquote. With the CIA's financial backing, Brown used his contacts with the underworld and a, quote, rugged, fiery Corsican, unquote, named Pierre Ferry Pisani, to recruit an elite criminal terror squad to work the docks. Surrounded by his gangster hirelings, Ferry Pisani stormed into local communist headquarters and threatened to make the party's leadership, quote, pay personally for the continuing boycott. And, as Time magazine noted with great satisfaction, quote, the first communist who tried to fire Ferry Pisani's men was chucked into the harbor, unquote. In addition, the Guarini's gangsters were assigned the job of pummeling communist picket lines to allow troops and scabs onto the docks, where they could begin loading munitions and supplies. By March 13th, government officials were able to announce that, despite a continuing boycott by communist workers, 900 dockers and supplementary troops had restored normal operations on the Marseille waterfront. Although sporadic boycotts continued until mid-April, Marseille was now subdued and the strike was essentially over. But there were unforeseen consequences of these Cold War, quote, victories. In supplying the Corsican syndicates with money and support, the CIA broke the last barrier to unrestricted Corsican smuggling operations in Marseille. When control over the docks was compounded with the political influence the milieu gained with CIA assistance in 1947, conditions were ideal for Marseille's growth as America's heroin laboratory. The French police later reported that Marseille's first heroin laboratories were opened in 1951, only months after the milieu took over the waterfront. Gaston Defferre and the Socialist Party also emerged victorious after the 1947 and 1950 strikes weakened the local Communist Party. From 1953 until the present, the Socialists, Defferre and the Socialists, have enjoyed an unbroken political reign over the Marseille municipal government. The Guarinis seem to have maintained a relationship with Marseille's Socialists. Members of the Guarini organization acted as bodyguards and campaign workers for local socialist candidates until the family's downfall in 1967. The control of the Guarini brothers over Marseille's heroin industry was so complete that for nearly 20 years they were able to impose an absolute ban on drug peddling inside France. At the same time, they were exporting vast quantities of heroin to the United States. With their decline in power, due mostly to their unsuccessful vendetta with Marcel Franceschi in the mid-1960s, their embargo on domestic drug trafficking became unenforceable, and France developed a drug problem of her own. Now, before we go on and discuss this, I just want to check with you, Dave. Is this not the same Tom Braden who has since become a TV broadcaster? Yes.
And not only that, but on the cable news, he's the resident liberal.
Exactly. He is the left to Pat Buchanan's right, which is, again, folks, just evidence of the kind of real wide range of opinions that we have available to us on network broadcasting. As Dave is talking about, we're talking about a program on CNN called Crossfire, where Tom Braden, this guy who's talking about helping Irving Brown and his federation to pay off the Corsican thugs on the docks to beat up and kill communists. This guy is now representing the left on a cable television debate program. Anyway, so now what we've seen here is in the 1947 and 1950 strikes in Marseille, that direct CIA support and psychological warfare and money support at that of the Corsican gangsters led to essentially creating the perfect environment for the heroin laboratories that would become the major heroin laboratories supplying the United States. So time after time, we've seen it already in Sicily and in France, where direct intervention by American intelligence and military has put the gangsters in power and then has given the gangsters the power themselves to begin the heroin traffic. And as we're going to see, folks, these are not isolated occurrences, and in fact, the pattern begins, continues to grow and grow and grow.
And again, reiterating, we have U.S. intelligence alliances with the Sicilian Mafia and the Union Chorus using both. Well, the Sicilian Mafia initially used to guard the U.S. waterfront and eventually also used to help pave the way for Patton's invasion of Sicily. But the primary role of both the Mafia in Sicily, the Union Chorus in Marseille, are as anti-communist cadres. The power given to these two criminal syndicates via their alliance with U.S. intelligence places them in a position to effect a resurgence of the world heroin trade, and that's just what they did. We've already looked at the Luciano organization's resurgence in Sicily and its eventual use of Cuba as a transshipment point. Now we're going to take a look at the alliance, at how both of these groups, both the Sicilian Mafia, the Onorata Società under Lucky Luciano, and the Union Chorus in Marseille, and we're going to look at these two groups hooking up. Again, the two criminal syndicates boosted by U.S. intelligence via their support for these syndicates as anti-communist cadres now hook up and dominate the world heroin trade. Returning once again to the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy. The basic Turkey-Italy-America heroin route continued to dominate the international heroin traffic for almost 20 years with only one important alteration. During the 1950s, the Sicilian Mafia began to divest itself of the heroin manufacturing business and started relying on Marseille's Corsican syndicates for their drug supplies. There were two reasons for this change. As the diverted supplies of legally produced Schiaparelli heroin began to dry up in 1950 and 51, Luciano was faced with the alternative of expanding his own clandestine laboratories or seeking another source of supply. While the Sicilian mafiosi were capable international smugglers, they seemed to lack the ability to manage the clandestine laboratories. Almost from the beginning, illicit heroin production in Italy had been plagued by a series of arrests, due more to mafiosi incompetence than anything else, of couriers moving supplies in and out of laboratories. The implications were serious. If the seizures continued, Luciano himself might eventually be arrested. Preferring to minimize the risks of direct involvement, Luciano apparently decided to shift his major source of supply to Marseille. There, Corsican syndicates had gained political power and control of the waterfront as a result of their involvement in CIA strikebreaking activities. Thus, Italy gradually declined in importance as a center for illicit drug manufacturing, and Marseille became the heroin capital of Europe. Although it is difficult to probe the inner workings of such a clandestine business under the best of circumstances, there is reason to believe that Meyer Lansky's 1949-50 European tour was instrumental in promoting Marseille's heroin industry. After crossing the Atlantic in a luxury liner, Lansky visited Luciano in Rome, where they discussed the narcotics trade. He then traveled to Zurich and contacted prominent Swiss bankers through John Pullman, an old friend from the rum-running days.
These negotiations established the financial labyrinth that organized crime still uses today to smuggle its enormous gambling and heroin profits out of the country into numbered Swiss bank accounts without attracting the notice of the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. So again, the two crime syndicates boosted into a position of primacy in Italy and France and Sicily by virtue of their alliances with the U.S. intelligence have now hooked up and represent the dominant factor in importing heroin. Now, this connection, folks, the one we've just been looking at here, this cooperation between the Sicilian Mafia and the Union Chorus, the transshipment going first from Turkey to Sicily to the Marseille laboratories down to Cuba and up into the United States, that is the French connection, about which the series of popular movies starring Gene Hackman was about, maybe a decade or two ago. But that connection, that French connection, which has proved just as elusive as in the popular motion pictures, was formed through this alliance of U.S. intelligence with these criminal syndicates. The phenomena we've just described is the formation of the so-called French connection.
And as we're going to talk about a little bit later in the broadcast, and as many of our longtime listeners are familiar with, the book that we quote from very often, and I think we're even going to use at least once tonight, The Great Heroin Coup by Heinrich Kruger, is about the overthrow. The word coup in this case refers to the overthrow of the French connection, the old French connection heroin traffic, by a heroin connection found more amicable to the Nixon administration, and we'll get into that later, and that's the Golden Triangle heroin connection. So we're going to talk about that's the heroin coup referred to in the book The Great Heroin Coup.
Now, so far, we've taken a look at a wartime alliance and an immediate post-war alliance between U.S. intelligence and criminal syndicates in both Sicily and Marseille and Corsica, the Onorata Società, or Mafia as it's commonly known, and the Union Chorus, the Corsican organized crime syndicate so influential in Marseille. Now we're going to take a look at an alliance between U.S. intelligence and an organized crime syndicate, again, with very strong political and anti-communist overtones and activities, this one in China.
Indeed. Now, those of you who are, again, perhaps not as familiar as they'd like to be with world history may have heard of Chiang Kai-shek and not be exactly sure of where he came from. Chiang Kai-shek was a man who rose out of the chaos that was China at the turn of the century. There was a period at the time when the influence of the Chinese government, the monarchy in China, had declined sharply. More and more, the Chinese were being dominated in the coast cities by the European powers who had set these coast cities up, places like Macau, Hong Kong, Shanghai, etc. Basically, China was a country torn apart, a huge country, too. It's still, and even at that time, it was by far the most populous country in the world, in utter and total political disarray. Well, as so often happens in these cases, and we're seeing it right now in Corazon Aquino's attempt to try and standardize the government of the Philippines a little bit, she's facing a lot of resistance from warlords scattered all over the provinces. Well, this is what China was like in the 19-teens and 1920s. It was essentially the province of the Europeans in the capital cities, the old monarchy and the elite, and some of those people in the coastal cities, and warlords out in the provinces. And warlords were exactly what they sounded like. Essentially, it was strongman rule. They were small groups of essentially armed bandits who had set themselves up in positions of power. A lot of these people were, in fact, themselves very heavily involved with the then burgeoning opium traffic in China.
Right. Now, it's worth noting that initially there was an alliance between a group called the Kuomintang, then headed up by a man named Sun Yat-sen, who's generally regarded as probably the single greatest patriotic figure in the history of China, although, you know, perhaps one could call Mao Zedong or someone else at this stage of the game. But for many, many years, Sun Yat-sen was the dominant patriotic figure in China. His political group, the Kuomintang, or KMT, as we'll see it abbreviated here, set about to centralize China. While Sun Yat-sen was heading up the Kuomintang, they formed a political alliance with the Chinese Communist Party for the purpose of overcoming the warlords and centralizing China. When Sun Yat-sen died, the Kuomintang was taken over by Chiang Kai-shek, who was bitterly anti-communist, and while at the same time maintaining the appearance of preserving the alliance Sun Yat-sen had formed with the Chinese Communist Party, in fact, Chiang Kai-shek set about plotting against that party, often with the connivance of some of the very warlords he was supposedly trying to conquer, and eventually Chiang initiated a very bloody purge, which was to set off a civil war lasting roughly two decades, going through the period of World War II and eventually culminating in the Chinese takeover of the country. And, of course, to this day, the mainland of China is the People's Republic. But it began with this break between the Kuomintang and the Chinese communists under Chiang Kai-shek.
Indeed. And as Dave mentioned, at the time when Chiang Kai-shek pulled the Nationalist Party away from its more progressive roots, he made alliances with, among other people, the warlords and the reactionary elements that had been left over from the old monarchic days. Okay, so this is Chiang Kai-shek, he himself, a sort of young warlord in charge of Sun Yat-sen's Nationalist Party, and KMT, the Kuomintang, the party he was in charge of.